WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Students in Black Washington, D.C. schools were recently surveyed about things they consider acting white. One thing on the list was going to the Smithsonian Institution. My guest Henry Louis Gates was appalled by what that said about how some African Americans now define blackness. It's a subject of enormous concern to him as one of the leading African American cultural and literary critics. Gates recently became the chair of Harvard's Afro-American Studies Department. The subjects he writes about range from rap music and movies to slave narratives and African fiction. He testified in support of the rap group Two Live Crew at their obscenity trial. A new collection of Gates' essays has just been published called Loose Cannons, Notes on the Culture Wars. Several of the essays challenge the literary canon, the great books every educated American is supposed to have read. Other essays challenge Afrocentric approaches to history and literature. The African American Studies Department Gates runs at Harvard is not Afrocentric.
The Afrocentric scholar seems to think that you have to be black in order to understand African American people, African American thought. I think that that's vulgar essentialism. I think that if someone said that I couldn't write about Shakespeare because I was not of Anglo-Saxon descent, that we would all agree that that person was racist. That, in a nutshell, is the primary difference. I think that the whole point of being in the Academy is that we can explore other cultures with great freedom, with great energy, with alacrity, and that one of the great Chinese historians is an Englishman named Joseph Needham. I mean, you don't have to be the thing in order to understand the thing that you're studying.
Now, you've also said that you think Afrocentrism has invented a past that never existed. I wonder what you think are some of the kind of bogus Afrocentric theories that have caught on.
Well, I think that my complaint is not about the conclusions per se, it's about the people who are drawing the conclusions. My argument is that you can't write about French literature unless you know the French language. You can't do it in translation. And many of the key people in the Afrocentric movement are not people who were trained in the languages requisite to make the claims that they are making. And what I would like to see is that those of us in Afro-American studies join hands with scholars in Near Eastern studies and in the traditional classics departments to train a new generation of scholars who can explore the ethnic and geographical and cultural complexity of the ancient European world and its relationship to Nubia and to Egypt, rather than for us to be dependent upon secondary sources and having no way to know what is the truth and what's not.
You're talking about finding out if, like, was Cleopatra really black?
Or how black the Egyptians were, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. Or even asking these questions in a way that not really appropriate to the society. I mean, for example, what did ethnicity mean to the Egyptians? If a person had kinky hair and black skin, did the Egyptians who didn't have kinky hair and black skin think of them as black in the same way that you, if you saw me, would call me black? These are problems of enormous complexity. And those of us who care about the truth, who care about scholarship, owe it to ourselves to walk very carefully through this very complicated terrain. I got in the mail not long ago a set of posters from a company that I won't name asking me for my endorsement. So I opened the scroll, and the first figure on the poster was Alexandre Dumas. And this is fine. Alexandre Dumas did indeed have an immediate black ancestor. The second one was Alexander Pushkin. I said, that's good. We're on a roll here. He, too, had an immediate black ancestor. But the third one was Josephine, the Queen, George III's wife, the Queen of England. The fourth one was Severus Septimus, the Emperor of Rome. And the fifth one was a Beethoven done up in blackface with a big afro. I mean, really, we have to separate the wheat from the chaff. It's a time of exciting rediscovery about the African past. Much of our true heritage and our achievements have been systematically taken away and denied us because of racism. I make no mistake about that. It's just that we can't go back and reclaim everybody with a touch of the tar brush just because we happen to like them. Or we can't will a black civilization into existence, just because we want it to be that way. I hope that the Egyptians owed everything to black Africa, but I was not trained as an Egyptologist. I'm not in a position to make that claim, and neither are many of the people in the Afrocentric movement who are making that claim.
Just one thing about Beethoven. I've actually heard for years that Beethoven was really black. Is that not true?
Well, to
I don't know.
To quote my two daughters, not. There is no way. In fact, many musicologists have explored Beethoven's biography, and it's just not a stitch of evidence. I wish that there were. I mean, I happen to like Beethoven. But you see, you talk about the differences within the Afro-American studies movement. I think that many of us feel that the only way to recuperate Beethoven, the only way to justify our affection for him and our regard for his music, is in effect to make him black. That somehow, if you are a black person and you like, say, Mozart, ballet, and ice hockey, to pick some examples, that you're less authentically black than someone who likes John Coltrane to do the boogaloo and vacationing on Sag Harbor. You know what I mean? That there is an authenticity which has to be embraced, and I think that that's very superficial.
So how are you dealing with students who were really hoping that the program was going to be more Afrocentric than it's going to be under you?
Well, the students, I taught the sophomore tutorial, which is the introduction to the major and each of the majors at Harvard, and we had 21 students, and they jokingly called our seminar Deprogramming 101. There was a great deal of affection in our disagreements, and I think that they would say that as well. I certainly felt a great deal of affection for them. College is in kindergarten. I mean, my job is not to be a cheerleader for these students. My job is to challenge them, to make them think, to show them if there are errors in the processes of thinking. They're entitled to the ideological conclusion or position or the methodological position that they want to take on our subject. We don't encourage one way of viewing things, but we do encourage clear thinking.
When you were studying at Cambridge, you studied with the Nigerian writer Wole Soyinka, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1986. Now, studying with an actual African writer, did your eyes and ears get open to things you hadn't been aware of before? And how do you think it affected your view of Afrocentrism to have studied at, you know, a young age with an African writer?
Well, it freed me in certain curious ways. I'll tell you a story about our first meeting. Soyinka was there at Churchill College at the University of Cambridge in exile from the Nigerian government. Remember the Nigerian Civil War in the late 60s? Soyinka had been in prison for 27 months. People had tried to kill him. When he finally got out, people in the government were still trying to kill him, so he fled. He took political exile, and he ended up teaching at Cambridge, which is just my good fortune because I got a Mellon Fellowship from Yale to study at Cambridge, and I enrolled in the PhD program in English. Well, I wanted to study, take a tutorial in African literature, and he was the only person there, and I petitioned him, and he decided that he would do it. Well, I figured that I would have to impress him with my extensive knowledge about Africa, which I did not have any of. And so I read a book called Muntu, M-U-N-T-U, by the German scholar Jan-Heinz Jahn, a very well-respected scholar. But this, in many ways, that is a pivotal text in the Afrocentric movement, because what Jahn did was look at all these African civilizations, societies, and languages over 1,000, and then boil them down to their essence, these seven principles or seven repeating characteristics that unite all of these disparate African countries and African cultures. So I memorized these, Muntu, and the names aren't important. So I practiced them. I practiced saying them correctly. I had the definitions down. I went over to see Professor Soyinka. I walked in. I had this big afro about 2 feet high, and he looked balefully at my afro, and he said, sit down. And he said, yeah, I want to tell you that you're my only student at this university, and the only reason I decided to take you was that you didn't come to me talking any of that Muntu bullshit. And I said, Muntu? I never heard of it. The point was that what Soyinka impressed on me was that there are over 1,000 African cultures and that many have absolutely nothing to do with each other. And that until we in the academy study those separate cultures sufficiently, we can't even begin to generalize about an African this or about an African that. There is no such thing as an African culture. Nevertheless, in much of the scholarship in Afro-American studies, particularly that commonly called Afrocentric, people generalize horribly about all the connections between these various African societies. Soyinka also taught me that to feel authentically black, quote-unquote, I didn't have to mimic a culture which I had learned from someone else, that I could be myself in all of its hyphenated complexity in the United States and still have the credentials to study Yoruba culture, which is his culture and the culture that I have a particular affinity for and a very high regard for. In effect, he freed me from much of the belatedness that African Americans feel when they confront Africa. And that, I could never thank him enough for that.
When you say he freed you from mimicking cultures that you weren't really a part of, you're referring to African culture, but did he also free you from feeling that you had to be a kind of a streetwise, urban person, because you grew up in a small town in Virginia, and I don't think you were part of that kind of streetwise culture.
No, but when I went to Yale, I remember I went to the first meeting of the Black Student Alliance at Yale. That was the only black student organization. I became secretary of that organization that first semester. And I felt so much anxiety because I felt that I didn't know what it meant to be black, because being black, if being black meant this sort of urban hip culture, because I grew up in Piedmont, West Virginia, population 2000, mostly white. And a friend of mine, who's now a prominent surgeon, a black man from North Carolina, was walking out of the first meeting with me, and he said, "I don't know what's wrong with these guys." He said, "I've been black all my life." And I looked at him, and I thought, so have I. It's just that there are different kinds of black experience. And that conversation was very liberating for me. I didn't have, to pretend that I was, a hip-hop boy, but to be black.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Henry Louis Gates. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Henry Louis Gates is my guest. He's the head of the African American Studies Department at Harvard and author of a new collection of essays called Loose Cannons, Notes on the Culture Wars. Now, you're really critical about two different sides here. On one side, we have Afrocentrism. On the other side, we have the canon, which you criticize for having virtually eliminated people who aren't white men.
Right.
So you have your problems with the canon, too. Let me ask you now to sum up those problems.
Well, as you can see, my problems with the canon are that both sides are firing at me. my problem with the sort of Alan Bloom, William Bennett wing of the American educational establishment was that essentially the intellectual contributions of persons of color and women were written out of even consideration for the canon for a very long time. That's no longer the case. But now that there's so many people of color and women in the canon and indeed in the academy, though not enough, there's a rear guard action has been very active since about 1985, 1986, protesting the loss of standards, the end of civilization as we know it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that what I've been trying to do and what I try to do in the book is to show that to integrate the canon, and we'll always have a canon, for every time a professor prepares a syllabus for a one-semester course, that is the construction of a canon. I mean, if only for pedagogical purposes, we will have a canon. I want to show that there is no diminishment of standards, quote-unquote, no loss of excellence, quote-unquote, simply because we let in African-American women into the academy. That itself is both racist and sexist in the first place. So I've been trying to take a very middle-of-the-road, solid, sensible position to a highly charged, emotional debate. And I don't think that I wonder how successful I have been in converting the right. I'm not sure that I have.
I wonder if you feel that there are any dilemmas a black intellectual faces that a white intellectual doesn't in our culture.
Yeah, I think that the fact that there's so few of us in the academy, only 800 black people get PhDs each year, and half of these are in education. So if you take those away, that means that the PhDs in academic disciplines like history and literature and sociology, amount to 400. 400 a year. We are a very scarce commodity, so that the burdens on us are overwhelming. We get to a new place, we're put on 100 committees. I mean, we're made to do, there are never enough black people at any of these universities. We're made to do the work of 10 people. Then we have to be sort of father and mother figures for our students, all of which we accept willingly, but none of this puts words on the printed page, which is how a scholar is judged. So that the burdens on a black academic are enormous. Also, the political burdens. I mean, what's our responsibility for the larger black community? For the fact that we have two nations in America, both of them are black. Two nations, one doing very well, one not doing well at all. Paradoxically, we have the largest black middle class and the largest black underclass in existing simultaneously. And we have to do something about it. These are enormous pressures.
Now, what about the language of academic criticism, which lately has been the language of deconstruction, structuralism? Are you comfortable with that language? It's certainly a different kind of language than you'd write, than you'd use in writing a piece about John Singleton in the New York Times. Do you like the language of the academy?
Well, I think that we have to be multilingual. I think that if my brother's an oral surgeon, when he and his friends are together, they talk about teeth, but I don't know that it's teeth that they're talking about. I mean, they might as well be speaking Russian. And lawyers, the same thing. But so when we have the right to our own jargon, and each generation of literary critic has had her or his own jargon, which is shared. The new critics had theirs, the post-structuralists have theirs, deconstructionists have theirs, et cetera, et cetera. I happen to find it a convenient shorthand when you're speaking to the converted or to someone fluent, but it's very alienating if you're not, and so that we have to find other ways to write. I think that that's why I published Loose Cannons, because it doesn't have very much jargon in it, unlike my previous book, The Signifying Monkey, which is full of jargon. Signifying Monkey was what we call the tenure book. Now I'm tenured, I could write any way I want, and it's good. I think I learned about this that academic jargon was not transparent and accessible to anyone, though I shouldn't have had to learn about that. When I gave my first public address at it happened to be a black school, and it was full of structuralist jargon, and it was called Binary Oppositions in Chapter 1 of Frederick Douglass's Narrative, and the audience was very polite. They gave me polite applause after I had finished. I asked for questions, and a young black man in the back raised his hand and stood up and said, "Yeah, brother, all we wanted to know is Booker T. Washington and Uncle Tom or not?" And that was, I had been deconstructed or signified upon. And I now often when I go to speak, I take two versions of a talk or two different talks. One is very academic, one is very accessible. And if I get there and the audience consists of non-academics, then I give them a non-academic talk. There's nothing more embarrassing than to be boring because people can't understand your language or because you're too insensitive to your audience's needs.
I want to ask you if you think your children are growing up between worlds, and if you think that's maybe a good thing in a way. I believe your wife is white, so your children would be growing up in, you know, a multicultural household.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very exciting. I think that they live literally in a multicultural world that we all experience figuratively. I mean, America is a hyphenated culture. There is no such thing as black culture, quote unquote, without white culture, which was the great lesson that James Baldwin gave to us, that white people as such did not exist until America. There was no need for you to be white if you were from Lithuania or Poland or Germany. You were German, Polish, or Lithuanian or English, etc. And similarly, black people didn't exist until the New World because one was Yoruba, or one was Igbo, or one was Gogo, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that my children's world only makes literal that which is implicit in the great experiment that is the United States. But we have all sorts of art in our house. I mean, my younger daughter plays the cello and piano. My older daughter plays piano. They like black music. They like rap. They like Beethoven. I think that I'd like to see them grow up with a fine aesthetic sense, recognizing that beauty can appear in and express itself in myriad ways, not just in ways that look like black people.
I want to read something that you wrote in your Yale admissions personal statement. This is part of like the essay question to get in. You wrote, "My grandfather was colored, my father is Negro, and I am black." What did that statement mean to you when you wrote it, and what does it mean to you now?
Well, I thought that if that didn't get me into Yale, nothing would. I think that It's funny you mentioned that because I'm writing a book this summer, which in the form of a letter to my two daughters, describing, and it consists of three parts. The first part will be what the colored world was like in the 50s when I was a child, roughly their age, and through my mother and father's eyes, at least from my point of view. And the second part will be about being moving from being a Negro in the 60s to a black, proud black person with an Afro and going off to college. And then the final part will be about what I imagine their world as hyphenated Americans will be in the 21st century. To me, it meant that, you have to remember, I was 15 in 1965. That was the summer of the Watts riots. And a year later, Stokely Carmichael was talking about black is beautiful, and then we were all growing Afros. We thought that once we were black and claimed that black was beautiful, that all our problems would disappear, that never again would we have the psychological burden of inferiority, the remnants of slavery, that all that had been dispelled. Well, it's not the way it happened, which is why Jesse Jackson had to have a press conference a couple years ago and declare that we're now African Americans. I think that this urge to rename each generation in order to find a new authentic identity is a sign of our sheer powerlessness and the fact that we have not analyzed the nature of the oppression that black people face in this country sufficiently. We're too content to try to manipulate symbols rather than to understand how race and class produce a compounding effect.
It's an interesting statement. Let me just ask you if you're comfortable with the African-American name of this generation.
I happen to like the name African-American because I'm an Africanist and an African-Americanist. That is, I write about mm-hmm. African cultures and write about African-American cultures. But I couldn't care less what a person uses. They could say colored. They could say Negro. It depends on how they say it. If it's not said with malice, I don't get any kicks out of telling someone they've just offended me because they've called me the wrong kind of name. There are some people who could say African-American. It would sound just like nigger. So it's not the word itself. I think we have to get away from that kind of superficiality about our own blackness. I think that the most pressing issue that we can face is how did we arrive at a moment in history when we have the largest black middle class and the largest black underclass? It's not an accident that the most urgent issue in Afro-American studies is, unfortunately, whether or not the pharaohs were black. The reason that this question is so important is that nobody knows how to deal with the real problems that face us, which are the causes of oppression for such a large number of our people, precisely when also, simultaneously, such a large number of us are freer than we've ever been. So it's because that's so difficult, it's a lot easier to fantasize about what happened 3,000 years ago in languages that we don't even read.
Well, Henry Louis Gates, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Henry Louis Gates is the chair of Harvard's African American Studies Department. His new book, Loose Cannons, Notes on the Culture Wars, is published by the Oxford University Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.